You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, as the country faces a recession, we'll take a look at a new report that says the economic growth of the Midwest could provide the roadmap to recovery. First, absentee voting is expected to be used by a record number of Americans in the November election. But recent changes at the U.S. Postal Service being made by new Postmaster General Louis DeJoy have mail carriers and lawmakers worried that mail-in ballots could be delayed. DeJoy was appointed by the Postal Service's Board of Governors in May and last month put in place several cost-cutting measures. The House Oversight Committee has asked him to appear at a hearing on September 17th to explain those changes and how they could affect the upcoming elections. Michelle Lee is a reporter with the Washington Post National Political Enterprise and Accountability Team. Michelle, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, can you tell us a little bit about the background of this new Postmaster General, Louis DeJoy?
Yes. Louis DeJoy is a longtime Republican donor and a fundraiser. In fact, he was the lead fundraiser for President Trump's reelection, the host convention by the Republican Party, which will happen in the next couple of weeks. And so he is a very well-known figure in Republican donor circles and fundraising circles. And he is also a logistics executive who built his career in North Carolina. He donated more than $2 million to the Republican political committees in just the past 4 years. So he comes with a pretty heavy political tie to the president as well as the Republican Party. And then he was tapped as the next Postmaster General just in May.
What are some of the cost-saving measures he's put in place since he took over this job?
Well, first, it's important to remember that the Postal Service has been mired in debt for a long time. They have been quite financially unstable for about a decade or so. So when Louis DeJoy took office, you know, a lot of people looked to him to enact some changes that would be financially beneficial to the Postal Service. Essentially, what the Postal Service says they're doing is making changes so that it would be a lot more efficient. Eventually, the agency would run in a more financially stable manner. And some of the changes that they've put into place is limiting the pickup time for mail carriers to be able to actually pick up the mail that they would deliver so that they don't linger for too long. They're shutting down mail sorting machines in some places earlier than usual, presumably to save costs. But that's actually leading to workers sorting by hand more, which is taking longer. And the Postal Service is no longer paying overtime. And that's important because there's a big tradition among postal delivery folks who work overnight, like in the nights, over holidays, over weekends, through rain, through snow, to make sure that mail is delivered on time, but they no longer can work those hours.
Are mail consumers, the people around the country, seeing a difference in mail delivery times because of these changes?
Well, we have gotten quite a few voters all over the country who have been telling us that they have not gotten their ballots on time for the most recent elections just past this past week. We have residents from many states saying that they actually have a system. They're signed up for a subscription service through the mail service where they get a daily update on their mail, but they're actually noticing that the daily updates are not coming daily anymore. And the postal workers themselves are telling us that they are experiencing days-long delays in being able to deliver the mail because of these changes that have been taken place. And they're also worried that the changes are just getting worse and longer because they can't work overtime to catch up to the backlog.
Talking to Michelle Lee, reporter with the Washington Post, about some changes at the U.S. Postal Service and concerns about delivering things like ballots in an election where people are expected to use a lot of mail-in ballots. And let's turn to that now, Michelle. The expectation, if I understand it correctly, is because of COVID-19 and some changes in state laws around the country, a lot of people will be mailing in their ballots this year. Is that right?
Yes, certainly. We have seen, certainly already, voters during the primaries choose to vote absentee because they're worried about showing up at the polls. I mean, they don't want to get themselves sick. They don't want to get others sick. And they're trying to avoid polling places. And many states are expanding the criteria for people to be able to vote from home by mail. So they're trying to make it easier for voters to use a mail service to cast their ballots. However, the anticipation of the growing use of vote by mail has also become politically sensitive because President Trump has been attacking the integrity of the vote by mail system as well. So the vote by mail system is expected to be used a lot more this coming fall, but it's also already being criticized by the president.
Let's bring on a caller. Lisa is with us in Janesville. Lisa, hi.
Hi. I don't know if this was mentioned while I was on the phone with your screener, but I did want to make sure people are aware that the debt that the post office is under is driven by the 2006 mandate that they pre-fund their retirement 50 years into the future. And without that, they would be in a much better financial shape, if not breaking even or making a slight profit. And in regards to the voting, I am hoping people will contact their representatives and ask that any COVID-19 funding include the post office being funded through January of 2021.
Lisa, thanks for the call. And that's an important point. There's that unique prepaid pension requirement that Congress gave to the U.S. Postal Service. I want to get into Lisa's point, though, about possible congressional help for the post office to get it through the elections. Is there any kind of talk out there, Michelle, of saying, okay, maybe we don't fix the long-term problems at USPS, but how do we make sure it works with mail-in voting?
Right. There's currently negotiations over the amount of federal funding that should go to the Postal Service to, you know, essentially bail them out and give them some sort of a cushion into the next year. For now, the Postal Service says they have enough stability to last into the next winter and spring. But that's really not a long term guarantee of their stability at all. Right now, the Treasury Department is negotiating with the Postal Service to provide a $10 billion emergency loan and trying to kind of figure out what the terms of those loans are moving forward. So there is some emergency and short-term funding, but it's certainly not a long-term solution.
Now, we've seen, thanks for that call. We've seen, Michelle, in some cases, Democrats accusing the president of, in effect, meddling with the Postal Service because of the likely surge in absentee balloting. They say, okay, we've got these changes and cuts. Well, we've got a president who's been criticizing absentee and mail-in ballots, except for in Florida. What has been the response from the White House and from the Postal Service to those kinds of accusations?
The president has been going after the Postal Service for some time now. You know, he has called it, quote unquote, a joke and has been demanding that it raise rates that it charges companies like Amazon. And Senate Democrats right now are trying to call Louis DeJoy into a hearing and try to get some answers out of him about what type of political meddling there may be or some sort of politically motivated actions that the Postmaster General may be taking. However, the Postal Service says that the Postmaster General answers to a bipartisan board of governors. He does not answer to the president, that the actions that the agency is taking are simply driven by the desire to make the Postal Service more efficient and effective. And President Trump and the White House, you know, they say that they are just committed to making sure that elections are done safely and securely and that they care about the integrity of the election.
Michelle, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Michelle Lee is a reporter with the Washington Post National Political Enterprise and Accountability Team. She talked to us today about changes happening under new Postmaster General Louis DeJoy, what it can mean for voting by mail in the November election. Coming up, we'll talk to the curator of an online museum exhibit about the history of toilet paper and Wisconsin's role in that story. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll learn about Wisconsin's place in the history of toilets and toilet paper. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with an answer to a listener's question about a neighboring state.
One of the most popular questions we've received from listeners through the Wisconsin Project relates to our neighbors in Michigan. Many of you have wondered, what's the deal with the Upper Peninsula? Why is it a part of Michigan and not Wisconsin? We sent Laura Pavin to the UP last football season to find out more.
Think about it. Wisconsin, it shares more than 200 miles of border with the UP. Michigan's Upper Peninsula is connected to its Lower Peninsula by a bridge. And yet, the UP's part of Michigan. But why? Well, it was never Wisconsin's for the taking. In the late 18th century, Michigan and Ohio got in a tiff over a small piece of land called the Toledo Strip. They fought over it until Congress stepped in and proposed a compromise. The territory of Michigan could become a state if it gave this strip of land to the state of Ohio. In return, Michigan would get all of the Upper Peninsula. Eventually, Michigan took the deal. Wisconsin had only just become a territory at this point. So here's an interesting thought experiment. Should the UP have gone to Wisconsin? Would it have made more sense geographically and culturally? To find the answer, I drove to the UP border towns of Marinette, Wisconsin, and Menominee, Michigan, and hung out with people at the bars during a football game. Because if you want to see where people's allegiances lie, you might as well take a look at what team they root for. And, drumroll please, the team of choice for Menominee residents I talked with was...
Packers.
Packers fan?
More of a Packer fan.
I hate the Lions. Hey, can I say that? I hate the Lions.
But why the Packers? Well, Green Bay's close to the UP. Plus, Packers games are broadcast on local TV. Beyond football, Wisconsinites and Upers also seem to share a bit of an accent.
Yeah, hey, don't you know? You betcha.
We say, oh. Oh, some people say we sound like Canadians.
Sounds familiar, doesn't it? Linguistics experts say that Wisconsin and the UP definitely share key features, like the long O, saying dem, dare, and doze. And some Upers and Wisconsinites share this thing called Canadian raising, which is basically where you say things like a boot instead of about. So, 2 points for Wisconsin, 0 for Michigan. Finally, there seems to be a deeper tension between the UP and their southern counterpart. Here's Kylie Sundstrom. She's lived in Menominee her whole life.
I think we just need to be separated. People all leave like the UP off of things, like maps and stuff.
More than a decade ago, a tourism commercial sponsored by the state of Michigan left the UP off, showed only the mitten. It actually led to legislation requiring that any official state publication show the state of Michigan in its entirety. So, Upers feel like they're left out of stuff. Some actually tried to make the UP its own state. All of this made me ponder. Do you need to be physically connected by more than just a bridge to feel like you're truly part of the same state? I asked Mary Antoine, a historian with the Prairie du Chien Historical Society.
In Wisconsin itself, there is an east-west. Living here in the southwest corner of Wisconsin, we feel that the whole eastern side of the state doesn't even know that we exist. That Wisconsin economy is totally focused on the greater Madison area and the Lake Michigan area from Chicago to Green Bay.
Culturally and geographically, Wisconsin and the UP look like they belong together. But continuous landmass or not, it seems like distance itself is the great divide here. That's something every state has to grapple with, including Wisconsin.
WPR producer Laura Pavin brought us that story. She answered an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, one of the more puzzling aspects of COVID-19 was the panic buying of toilet paper in the first weeks of the crisis. While we're past that for the most part now, it definitely put an often overlooked product in the spotlight. Wisconsin has played a big role in the history of toilet paper, and in toilets for that matter. The Hearthstone Historic House Museum in Appleton decided to put together an online exhibit to highlight it. George Schroeder is executive director of the Hearthstone Historic House Museum and put together the exhibit. It's called Flushed with Success, Milestones in Toilet Paper Development. George, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, one thing that strikes me looking at your online exhibit, George, is, you know, this product that we, you know, take as a necessity now. We go up and stock up on it at the first sign of trouble. It's really a pretty recent invention, or at least in common use, historically speaking.
Well, if you look at the long-term sort of history of toilets and toilet paper development, it is centuries old. Although the product itself, toilet paper, really starts in Victorian America. And if we think about it, it's one of the few Victorian industries that is still thriving today. So in some regards, it's old, it's 150 years old, but in some regards, it's very new, especially its marketing.
Talk about the rise of toilet paper, and it came along with flush toilets. The older answers to the problem that toilet paper solves didn't work necessarily with indoor plumbing.
Well, that's absolutely true. I mean, you know, if we think about your average privy, it can accommodate the entire Sunday edition of the New York Times. I mean, there's no limit to the amount of paper you can use. But once toilets started to develop, it became very clear that you needed a special product. It starts in the 1850s. A gentleman named Gaietti starts making sheets of toilet paper, mostly marketed for its medicinal value because you're not using the paper that has heavy inks, for example, that are in the Sears Roebuck catalog. And it really doesn't take off, though, until there's this larger installed base of toilets. And that comes together in the 1870s and 1880s.
Talk about Wisconsin's role in the rise of commercially available toilet paper.
Well, you know, toilet paper starts elsewhere. I mean, probably the most successful early company was the Scott Paper Company in 1890. They develop a high quality product that's sold as a luxury item, actually. It's sold exclusively to hotels under the Waldorf brand, like Waldorf Astoria, to get people sort of over this Victorian taboo of bathroom functions. It has pretty good success. And by the 1920s, they're the leading supplier in the world. But Wisconsin makes the product its own starting in 1901, when the Northern Paper Mill in Green Bay, where a lot of toilet paper is still made, enters the market with its Northern Tissue. And it actually starts vying with Scott by the 1920s as the leading toilet supplier in the world. Go ahead.
Something that struck me in your exhibit was a key innovation was when we had successful rolled toilet paper. That wasn't the case at the outset?
No, that wasn't the case at the outset. It was more like you would imagine a pack of tissue. So you pull out individual sheets. This gentleman named Gaietti actually watermarked each of the sheets with his name, which is a bold marketing move if you think about it. But it wasn't until Seth Wheeler decided in 1871 to come up with a new form. He's the first to combine a roll with tear-off sheets wound around a cardboard tube. And so his patents are really central to sort of what we call modern toilet paper. But again, there weren't enough toilets in the market yet, so he really wasn't terribly successful.
Has Wisconsin stayed a key player in the toilet paper market to this day?
No two ways about it. I mean, there's still thousands of jobs up and down the paper valley from Green Bay to Neenah that are involved in toilet paper manufacturing. Kimberly Clark is still making Scott brand toilet paper. Georgia Pacific is making Northern brand to this day. Procter & Gamble is making Charmin, which was started by the Holberg Paper Company in the 1920s in Green Bay. It is still a massively successful, massively important paper market. Something that is not going to be threatened by digitization like some of the printing papers. And so it is really a recession-proof market that is central to the economy of northeastern Wisconsin.
Toilet paper is often found near toilets, and same goes for production. We also have a pretty strong history of plumbing and toilet production here in the state. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, that is true. I mean, a lot of that stems from the Kohler Company, of course. Kohler was originally a manufacturer of farm implements and other sort of items like, well, horse troughs. And so it's a very short step if you're going from a horse trough to a bathtub. And that got them into the market. Of course, once you start making bathtubs, you might as well start making toilets and you might as well start making other fixtures. And so, yes, it's absolutely true that we are the center of toilet and toilet paper technology in certainly North America.
I had a lot of fun looking at your online exhibit, George. Can you walk us through what people will see if they go over and visit?
Well, you know, it really is about the milestones in toilet and toilet paper technology. We talk about the beginnings of flushable toilets in the 1700s. We then take through the really important developments in the 1870s and 1880s when it comes to ceramic design and U-shaped bends and stopcocks, which allow the plumbing to flow without a monitor on it, and then take us right into toilet paper and all the things that I've just talked about through, well, a real toilet paper shortage in Hawaii in 1971, and a not-so-real toilet paper shortage started by Johnny Carson in 1973.
Now, the exhibit is called Flushed with Success. I've got to express my admiration, George. You've gotten through this whole interview with not a lot of puns related to the product at hand.
I promised people that I would not. It is an easy and slippery slope. I tried to make this as academic as possible, which reflects best on the museum, if not necessarily on my usual attitude.
And talk about, as we wrap up, George, just what we can learn by looking at what we might take for granted as a common household product and digging into its history.
Well, you know, that's a great point, because digging into its history, I think, really gives us an appreciation of what the Victorian era was like. I mean, that's what we represent here at Hearthstone Museum. These are technologies, toilets and toilet paper, plus all kinds of other things like telephones and central heating that we take for granted today, that are really old technologies in terms of 150 years old, and yet they're still vital and vibrant today.
George, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much.
George Schroeder is the executive director of the Hearthstone Historic House Museum. He put together their online exhibit titled Flushed with Success, Milestones in Toilet Paper Development. We've got a link, by the way, over at WPR.org/Central Time. Take a tour through key moments in the history of toilet paper and Wisconsin's role in that history. Coming up, a new report from The Economist says Midwestern cities are vital to the region's growth and economic success. We'll talk to the author, who says that the Midwest in and of itself is a powerhouse, a potential big powerhouse on the world stage. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show, find out how goats are playing a big part in conservation efforts here in Wisconsin. That's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, a new report finds that the Midwest plays a more significant role in the country's economy than a lot of people might have thought. Our guests examine how the industries, politics, and culture of the Midwest affects its economic growth, and he says Midwestern cities are at the heart of the story. Adam Roberts is the Midwest correspondent for The Economist, covering politics, policy, and social affairs in America. He wrote a special report on the Midwest for The Economist. Adam, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much. Delighted to be with you.
I want to start with this number that kind of surprised me. If you stack up the Midwest as its own country and our economic output, we compare pretty favorably to a lot of just whole-on countries. Where do we fit in on the global stage?
Yeah, I think the Midwest packs a much bigger punch than many people realize. So if you just add up the population of the states of the Midwest, the 12 states that I count as the Midwest, you've got around 68 million people. That's the same population as the entire population of the UK or of France. And if you look at the economy of the Midwest, that's about $4 trillion. That's the fourth biggest economy on the planet. That's as big as Germany's economy. So I think we forget that sometimes. We think the Midwest is this declining region. Actually, it packs a pretty big punch.
And you point out at the outset of your big piece on the Midwest how central the region has been to American politics and culture lately. Can you spell out some of the big moments here?
Absolutely. So I've been in the Midwest for a couple of years, and I really wanted to come here. I wanted to be based in Chicago and to report from the heartland of America, because the punch that the Midwest packs when it comes to politics is just immense. If you look at which parts of America you have swing voters, where people who maybe backed Barack Obama then went to back Donald Trump, a lot of those are in the Midwest. States like Wisconsin were absolutely crucial in getting Donald Trump elected in 2016. The same states, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, will also be really important in 2020. So when it comes to electoral politics, it's this bit of America that really has a greater impact because that's where the swing voters are. And then in other ways, you look at social change, social disruption. We had the example from Minneapolis just a couple of months ago, the murder of George Floyd, and the complications that blew up from that, the protests and the effect that had on cities around the Midwest, around America, and then around the world. So I think the Midwest really does have a big influence on the rest of America and the rest of the world.
When people look in at the Midwest from the outside, I think, and you make this point, a lot of people think farmland and Rust Belt declining cities. Is that the stereotype still of the Midwest from the outside? We know it's wrong, and we'll talk about that, but is that how people still think of us?
I think it is, sadly. I think people have this phrase, flyover country, or this bit of America that you don't really want to go to see because it's between the coasts. And so the rest of the world doesn't really understand quite how much strength and opportunity and rejuvenation there is in the Midwest. I think there's a lot of prejudice that, as you just said, it's a place of farmers and sort of inward-looking people. And I found the complete opposite on my travels around the Midwest for the last couple of years.
Talking to Adam Roberts from The Economist, talking about a big piece he wrote about the economic and political future of the Midwestern United States. Adam, a key theme running through a lot of your writing on this is the role of cities. And you say for the region, for states, a lot of their future lives or dies by the success of their cities, even for the people who don't live in the cities themselves. Can you expand on that some?
Yeah, sure. So if you take a typical Midwestern state, and I'll take Illinois because that's one I know well because I live in Chicago, and you ask how much of the state's GDP, the gross state product, comes from the city versus from the rural areas, and you find that Chicago accounts for 80, 85, even higher proportions of the wealth that the state creates. In Wisconsin, a huge amount comes from Madison and Milwaukee. I think although we talk about the Midwest as having a lot of farmers, a lot of rural economy, in fact, just like the rest of America, it's the metro regions that create the most wealth. And a lot of the subsidies that then go to farmers come from those urban areas. And in the long run, it's the success, it's the health of those big cities that will decide how successful the Midwest as a whole will be.
There's a sense here in Wisconsin, and we've got a researcher named Kathy Kramer who researches this kind of thing a lot. You talk about similar things in Illinois. This sense that those metropolitan areas and the rural areas, they're not the same state. They're not in this together. Can you talk about the challenge that can pose?
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned Kathy Kramer. I think she's done some really important, really helpful research to spell this out. But as she says, the way that people in Madison or Milwaukee might see politics, see the future of their states, their attitudes, for example, on whether to welcome immigration, what sort of healthcare policy you want, can be so different, 180 degrees different from the views of people in small town, rural areas. And that split in terms of social values. Chicago, for example, has an African-American lesbian mayor. The people of Chicago are very happy with that, very relaxed about that. But you get out of the city into the small towns and you talk to people about the values that people have. And then they're a little bit more, what should I say, old-fashioned, a little bit less welcoming to progressive ideas, whether it's in politics or social life. So there's a very stark division between urban values and rural values.
Let's talk about a tale of two different types of cities. And this is something you do a lot in your piece, comparing and contrasting cities that have emerged from that sort of Rust Belt scenarios and ones that haven't. Do you see common themes in what works and what helps a city bounce back from, you know, the loss of that industrial base of the, you know, 50s and 60s?
Yeah. So, of course, my prejudice when I came to the Midwest a few years ago was, oh, I knew about Detroit and the collapse of its population. I'd heard about Rust Belt cities and how they were struggling to get on when factories closed and, you know, factory jobs disappeared. And as I traveled around the region and I went to all sorts of cities, I saw that some cities were learning to thrive again. They were finding, if not a magic formula, then at least some common approaches to help themselves thrive. And I looked at small places, relatively small ones like Ann Arbor in Michigan, Des Moines in Iowa. Maybe Madison doesn't count as a huge city, but it's a very successful one in Wisconsin. And I saw that the ones that work had a few things in common. And this often came down to getting their downtown areas to thrive again so that people wanted to come and play and go to restaurants and live there again. Then they were often cities that had a good university or a good healthcare system that would create very highly paid and high skilled jobs. And then there were some that were good at developing industry and going into advanced manufacturing, not just doing the old fashioned low skill manufacturing. And generally, cities that decided to save themselves, to tap into their own social capital, not hope that the federal government or some outsiders would come and rescue them. The ones who took it upon themselves to turn their fortunes around, they did the best. So somewhere like Grand Rapids in Michigan also did very well. Pittsburgh is a great example. Chicago's downtown is a great example of places that have learned to thrive again. And I think we can look across the region and see lots of reasons to hope, but it doesn't mean that every place can succeed.
You also compare and contrast two approaches. One, give a lot of money, give a lot of tax incentives to try to bring in big employers versus two, do the thing you were kind of just talking about, build up your social infrastructure, make it a nice place to live, and then use that to lure the business. How do you see those two approaches panning out?
Well, exactly. So I took an example from Wisconsin, the Foxconn investment that was much trumpeted. If you remember, about 3 or 4 years ago, Donald Trump came to Racine and trumpeted the Foxconn investment to build a huge factory to produce screens, that this was going to be the future of manufacturing. And as you well know, and your listeners know, there were all sorts of very generous subsidies promised to Foxconn to develop that industrial project down in southern Wisconsin. And to my mind, it hasn't been a great success. They haven't really got up and running yet. Whereas in contrast, you look at somewhere like Grand Rapids in Michigan, and it took the approach that it would take 20 or 30 years of creating a really attractive environment so that the existing manufacturers would stay and gradually you can persuade other ones to come in. And I think that the Grand Rapids model is a much more successful one than the Racine model.
Adam Roberts is with us, Midwest correspondent for The Economist. We're talking to him about a new report he wrote that lays out the economic diversity and potential growth of the Midwest. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What economic changes have you seen in the last few years in your own part of the Midwest, whether that's big city, small town, or somewhere in between? Are you hopeful about the future of Midwestern cities? Do you think that we could overcome divides in the Midwest between whether that's cities and the country, overcoming racial divides, which we'll get into in a few moments? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. With your thoughts or questions for our guest, we'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about what Midwestern cities could teach us about economic recovery and the role of the Midwest in the national and even global economy, and how politics, culture, academic institutions, and manufacturing all contribute to the potential for growth in states like Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you move to Wisconsin from outside the Midwest? What drew you here? Were there stereotypes about the Midwest that you found out were wrong or right? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to our callers now. Mike is with us in Appleton. Mike, hello.
Hi there, guys. How's it going today?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Mike?
Wanted to say, you were kind of looking for unique examples within the Midwest and how one can make their economy grow. I am actually a graduate of Northern Michigan University and lived in the Marquette, Michigan area between college and post-collegiate life for about 15 years. Since recently moved back down to Wisconsin, but in that time I've seen, you know, the greater Marquette region, because of you know, the advent of faster internet and everything like that, people can telecommute in positions, and really there's a lot of high-paying jobs here between the university, the healthcare system, and the fact that that people of wealth can actually just stay in a very nice little home there and still conduct business. And that has allowed for the local economy to really branch out for especially leisure products. Like you see a lot of longboards, a lot of mountain bike, things along the lines of that, snowboarding, of course.
Mike, I'm going to jump in because we already have a ton of time. You gave us a lot to work with. Let's go to our guest now, Adam Roberts from The Economist. Adam, there's that education, medical, and quality of life bundle that Mike is talking about there.
That's absolutely right. And I think he touches on something that is a real strength of the Midwest, which is maybe even more so with COVID-19 and uncertainty about what's happening to our economy in 2020 and 2021. Maybe people would rather not live in the biggest cities. Maybe they want to come to somewhere in the Midwest where they can have a higher quality of life. They don't have to pay so much for accommodation. And they can, as long as there's, as Mike says, a good internet connection, they can do a lot of work and a lot of getting by that they used to do in the big cities from smaller places. So there may just be an advantage in the Midwest as we go through this very difficult period with COVID-19.
Mike, thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Laura now in Wisconsin Rapids. Laura, hi.
Hi. I just was wondering if, well, I worked for the Consolidated Papers, our local paper company, for 19 and a half years. When they closed, they were Stora Enso. And since then, they've sold every single mill that was sold to different companies. And the last paper mill in central Wisconsin, owned by Consolidated Papers, just shut down July 31st. And that's like 915 workers that are now out of a job. And we have a new water park and a new mayor. And I'm just wondering, what can we do with an empty paper company, paper mill, and 915 people out of work?
Laura, thank you so much. I'm sorry for what your community is going through right now. Adam, are there thoughts there? This is not, factories closed 20 years ago. How do we recover? This is a story happening in real time now. Do you have thoughts on how a community can recover that from that?
Yeah. But, well, first of all, I'm really sorry that happened, and it must be a huge shock and terrible for everyone involved. If there's one very broad lesson for all places that might be hit by something like this, it's that the more educated your workforce is, the higher the level of education that people get, the more resilient they are, the more likely they can move from working in one industry to working in another. And so the advantage that states like Wisconsin, but also Minnesota, Illinois, the ones at the western end of the Midwest, their advantage is that they've invested more in education over the years. So on balance, more educated people have a chance to look for new sorts of work. I don't have any great insights into that particular industry, but in general, education helps a lot.
Thanks a lot for that call. One issue that you get into in your piece, Adam, I don't want to overlook it, is the challenge of racial disparities and segregation. You write that, you know, in communities like Milwaukee, we know, and others in the Midwest, we have lasting segregation, more so than most of the other country.
The rest of the country, yeah. So Milwaukee ranks as the most segregated city in America, the most racially segregated of all. I think one of the big problems for cities in the Midwest is if you're not growing fast, if you're not expanding your population, if you're not expanding your footprint and getting more resources, then it's harder to deal with segregation. It's harder to build new schools or to put up new housing that can help to unpick those barriers that are always still there. And I think, in a way, one of the ways to tackle the problems of segregation quicker is to find ways to be more economically resilient and how to grow faster, because that gives you the resources to take on that social challenge. But we've seen with what happened in Minneapolis and anger about the police that there are also policy changes that can be made to try to reduce the tension that can often exist between African-Americans and the police that is so pervasive in the Midwest and elsewhere.
Talking to Adam Roberts, Midwest correspondent for The Economist, about a big piece he wrote on the Midwest, its economic present and potential for the future. Let's go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Joe is with us in Star Lake. Joe, hello.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. My question is, how big a factor is this huge resource of fresh water of the Great Lakes to the survival and or the growth of the Midwest, and how they're working that out with Canada's claims on that water?
Joe, thanks for the call. A big long-running issue, the Great Lakes Compact. But Adam, the Great Lakes as potentially an economic driver now and in the future.
I think it's a huge resource for some areas. So I don't imagine that you can take the fresh water from the Great Lakes and export it somewhere else. I think that's not an option. But for the city of Milwaukee, that's made a real emphasis on developing the blue economy, creating companies that will develop technology that can be exported to countries like India or to the Middle East, where you can learn to use water in a much more efficient way to capture water. I know that Wisconsin has many, many companies that have really developed expertise that is going to be useful for the Chinese, for Indians and other parts of the world to tap into. I think that's where you can specialize in that resource. I don't know about Canada. I don't think that Canada is likely to steal any water from the Great Lakes because you do have this cooperation over the border. But for Milwaukee to push on with the blue economy sounds very sensible to me.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. I want to dive into something we've touched on already a little bit, Adam, the role of universities and schools and education. It's nice if you have one already, but if you're in a community having tough economic times without that, it's hard to start a new university from scratch. How can we harness that power, though, for the region as a whole?
Yeah, you're right. So it's not that everyone can just suddenly create a wonderful university like the University of Wisconsin at Madison. Of course, for the cities that have it, that's great, and you can do more with your university. You can create new companies. You can encourage entrepreneurs from those universities to move into new areas. Pittsburgh is a great model of this, moving into robotics and artificial intelligence that can then create jobs for other people to take advantage of. But for those cities that don't have a university, you can look to other forms of vocational education, how to get people the skills that companies really want to have. And I heard some great examples, for example, from Ohio, Columbus, Ohio, of developing the sort of vocational apprenticeships that Germany is very good at doing, that more and more cities in the Midwest are learning to do. So you get companies involved in helping to do the education as well. And then they get the sort of workers they need to work in advanced manufacturing, that sort of high-skilled vocational education. That's just as valuable in many ways as a four-year degree.
I wanted to talk to you, Adam, about cooperation versus competition. We've had in various states in the Midwest sort of economic border wars, like Wisconsin and Illinois trying to poach businesses or putting up ads to try to lure people to move from Chicago to Wisconsin. Is there a potential for cooperation that could benefit the region as a whole?
I think there is potential for cooperation. For example, you see this with transport infrastructure, or with the fact that cities as a whole, they spill over state borders. So Chicago is such a big economy that it will affect what happens in southern Wisconsin. So there's not a lot of point the states competing really hard with each other, definitely not by offering subsidies to try to lure Amazon or Foxconn or someone into the state. It makes a lot more sense for the states to get together, to look at what resources they have in common. And for example, with those transport links, to try to lower the cost of doing business because you have good rail connections or good road connections. Some people even talk about building a hyperloop system to link the big cities of the Midwest together. So I think there's a lot of scope for better cooperation.
In our last minute, Adam, what are you watching for most? What pulse, what indicator do you watch for when it comes to the future of the well-being of the region?
Well, I think right now we have to look at what's happening with this pandemic. It's overwhelmingly the important issue for whether schools can reopen, whether businesses can work again. And so keeping the pandemic in a box, try to suppress the pandemic, that's the first thing. In the really long term, I would look at education as the key indicator. Can you get more people to have a higher level of education beyond the high school degree up into a higher education? That's where prosperity comes in the long run. That's the 50, 60 year timeline you can be looking for.
Adam, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
We've been talking to Adam Roberts, Midwest correspondent for The Economist. He talked to us about a recent report he wrote that explored the outsized economic impact of the Midwest and possible roads for the region's future. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, the popular social media app TikTok is at the center of controversy, with the president even threatening to shut it down. We'll get the latest on that story. people in the U.S. consistently overrate their risks of being victims of crime. We'll look at some of the reasons behind that and why our guest says that misperception actually makes us less safe. And from exercise gear to puzzles, a lot of things sold out fast in the early days of the pandemic. We'll look at the things we buy in tough times and what it tells us about ourselves and our priorities. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 8, Kate continues our series of candidate interviews in Wisconsin's contested congressional primaries. You can find all of our candidate interviews and other election coverage online at WPR.org. That's tomorrow at 8 on the morning show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll learn about a pilot program in Rusk County that's bringing fresh and healthy produce to people who have a hard time finding healthy food in a rural part of the state. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.